Do you want me to do that for you, Tim?
Go on, then.
Okay. Here we are. Umbrella 360 Podcasts. You're coming live. We've got Tim Burrows interviewing Adam Ferrier and Margie Reed from Thinkabell.
You're listening to Umbrella Cast. Umbrella Cast.
Welcome to this special edition of the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows, coming to you from Sydney's Hilton Hotel in the midst of Mumbrella 360. Coming up later, we have our exclusive first listen, well, unless you're in the room, for the Mumbrella Wheel of Truth session, in which we threw some tricky questions at our panellists. But first, joining me in Mumbrella's hastily constructed press room today, we have Adam Ferrier, co-founder of Thinkabell.
Hello.
And Margie Reed, managing partner at Thinkabell. Welcome both.
Hello, and thank you.
So thanks very much for joining us, guys. Now, I was just looking along. It's pretty much 1 year this month, Adam, since you launched Thinkabell. Almost exactly 6 months since you joined, Margie.
Chalk and cheese, the first 6 months to the second 6 months is quite bizarre.
I imagine the second 6 months are a lot more organised.
A lot more organised, a lot smoother, and a lot more, in quotes, professional.
So... yeah, I suppose the opening question to both of you, how's business?
It's fun. It's we're having a lot of fun doing it. Obviously, a lot of hard work starting up a business, but working with the guys and the team, it's been a really good journey. Like, we've learned a lot and we keep pivoting and growing and learning along the way.
Margie, you and Adam, I'll come to you after this. You joined from OMD. You spent pretty much all of your career with media agencies, including a big chunk at OMD. Thinkabell, I suppose their heartland will be more as a creative agency. How are you finding that transition?
It's been an interesting transition, and working with the guys, I feel like I've learnt a lot, absolutely, in the last 6 months. I mean, obviously I've brought a lot to the agency, but collectively I think we've all grown together in terms of how do we bring creativity, how do we bring media, how do we bring brand, and then technology and consumer all together. And I think that's where that fun and that growing has absolutely happened. And I think working with, you know, Jim Cousin, Adam across that, but then even the broader team, we all bring such a unique offering and part of ourselves.
And Adam, you think about it's a chance for you to be part of a startup again, which you were with Naked Australia. You then joined Cummins & Partners, which obviously was already an established thing. Is it a bit sort of back to the future to be at a startup again?
Yeah, it kind of is a little bit. It feels fresh yet familiar. And I think that's kind of nice that you've kind of got established players doing a startup. It kind of gives you... lots of enthusiasm, lots of fun, lots of we can do whatever we want. But also we've got some heads on shoulders who kind of know the lay of the land and have built up kind of good skills and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of feels like the, you know, in some ways, the best of both worlds.
And you're slightly unusual in that one of your sort of founding investment partners, for want of a better phrase, is PwC. What difference does that actually make to... either the culture or the business?
The PwC thing, we describe them as friends with benefits, and that's exactly what it feels like. So we've got a kind of, if you like, I was going to say a big brother, but I mean that in a kind of a maternal sense, not a Orwellian sense. And they've been just fantastic friends to have in terms of giving us access to kind of grown-up big kind of brand and business problems to tackle. And it's just, it just feels nice having to be part of the emerging trend of kind of consultancies and agencies working more together and solving problems more holistically, and also just injecting a bit of creativity into a world otherwise kind of, which has been previously a bit more having a rational kind of efficiency approach, and now approaching certain... a new type of problems with a bit more creativity.
Well, Margie, to build on that, I was in Singapore last week talking to a couple of kind of the APAC CEOs who get to see the whole region. And there seems to be this real fascination of people looking at Australia where there's almost a view that there's this sort of the global petri dish right now is Australia, where you've got PwC. They're doing the CMO advisory. They're investing in you guys. You've got, you know, the monkeys obviously haven't been picked up by Accenture. You've got Deloitte doing their thing. Everybody is doing things in this space that they aren't necessarily doing in the rest of the world. What have we learned so far?
It's funny because, to Adam's point, I think culturally we work together with PwCs, but there's no, you know, there's a big brother element in a support mechanism, but we also are incredibly independent. And I think talking to a few people around here today, the fear of consultancy versus how it's actually able to enhance and how we can work together, and how do you keep that relationship and the journey of from big business problems through to, you know, everything that we do. I think that there's an element of how do we actually embrace this rather than the fear that it's creating.
I reckon for me it feels like 10 years ago it was kind of like the Wild West of media with the advent of the internet and social. It now feels like it's the Wild West of creativity, where it kind of feels like a creativity is being applied to a much broader palette of different types of problems. And I think the merging of consultancies and agencies together is part of that. So I think that's kind of really interesting. And I think it's kind of nice that Melbourne in particular is the home of that, because Melbourne's got a nice, strong kind of creative kind of vibe. And so it kind of feels befitting that that's where kind of business and creativity is kind of merging more.
And this might be an unfair question, and it might be about just high expectations. It feels to me like I haven't yet seen Thinkabell's big defining piece of work or piece of thinking. Have I missed something, or is it still to come?
I didn't realise this was going to be such an antagonistic, horrible, nasty interview. No, I'm kidding. Sort of. Look, we've been going for a year. We're incredibly proud of the work we've just done for 13 Cavs. We're proud of the work we've done for the Red Cross and Beat Loneliness. We've been working with the ABC and kind of done some work there. There's a few other brands that we've done some good things with. But I think I'm not after the one big kind of thing that you're going to see. We're after kind of an ongoing kind of a whole lot of proof points of different types of business problems to have solved through, you know, good creative thinking. And so I think that'll just emerge more and more as the journey continues.
Are you guys as big as you would have hoped to be at this point?
We're bigger. This is going to sound funny. Size doesn't matter. But I think for us, yes, we've grown at a bigger rate. We're having to look for another office at the moment. We've already outgrown our space. So I think for us, yeah, we're absolutely growing at a pace that we hadn't thought was possible. But to answer and to follow on from the question, I think we've been doing so much work around our brands with our clients that, you know, to Adam's presentation just now, that's what we've been working through. And I think over the next couple of months, you'll see a lot of that come to life.
And we'll talk to Adam's presentation in a moment, because there are a couple of sort of fascinating points in that. Just on the subject of Adam, I always wonder, because I've observed him with some interest over the last, 10 years, 12 years now, sort of with his time in Naked. He strikes me the sort of person who will be both fascinating and incredibly annoying to work with. Yeah. I mean both of those things. Is that true?
I was going to insert the word irritating for you, but I held back. No, he's amazing. His mind is 10 paces ahead, but at the same time, keeping him on check is one of those tasks. But, you know, we're having a lot of fun doing it, and I think we've both learned a lot from each other.
Yeah, but in that little dissection of me, fascinating, irritating, annoying, there wasn't a compliment in that. There wasn't a positive side.
Fascinating. Fascinating is a big compliment.
Okay. All right, thank you.
No, if I was to do my most 10 interesting people in media, you would be on the list.
Oh, thank you.
But I think you might also be on the list of 10, I don't know because I don't know, but 10 most irritating colleagues might be on the list.
I say irritating in an endearing way. This does sound
very critical. No. I am amazed that people choose to spend time with me at all. So I just thank everyone for even listening to this. I'm sure I'm irritating you right now.
But honestly, what are you like to work with?
Difficult. I'm difficult.
He loses everything.
I'm difficult because I'm disheveled. I'm difficult because I like to assert a point of view. And sometimes I don't listen as much as I should. Although I'm anyway, so I'm difficult, but I'm also, I think I'm creative and lateral, and I also am obsessed with, I'm really interested in people and marketing, and so I can bring a lot of knowledge as well, I think.
The topic you spoke to at Mumbrella 360 was human-centered design and the flaws of it, which I think if I had to sum it up in my simplistic way would be every category effectively solves the same problem, so all brands end up looking the same. And I watched you present one thing where you put the slides up of a number of brands and how much they've gone from their original sort of font to a very, very similar font. And I cringed a little because I felt that Mumbrella might be in that department as well.
I think Mumbrella could be. I think I preferred the old look of Mumbrella. I think it was more distinctive and stood out a lot more. I think you're
distinctive. The one assets. That I made in Word in 10 minutes.
That's right. But I think
Mumbrella versus the one that a brilliant professional slaved over for months.
I think you may have lost a little bit by smoothing out the rough edges. I think you may have become a little bit more homogenized, but I'm sure, you know, your business is doing well. But
we're going all right. Yeah. Thank you for your concern. So human-centered design. Good or bad for the industry?
I think it's slightly misleading. I think it's it's up its own arse a little bit and forgetting what it's in the business of doing. Human-centered design is in the business of helping businesses build brands at the end of the day. And if you forget that, or if you don't realize or understand you're in that business, then you're probably not part of the solution. And so I think sometimes people aren't honest enough about it. Like, it reminds me of in psychology, we never spoke about the fact that we're in the job of changing people's behavior. As a clinical psychologist, people come to a psychologist to have their behavior changed, and you work with them to change it. Businesses come to us to build brands, not to necessarily understand consumers in and of itself. We want to understand people to use that information to help build a brand and build a business, and that's kind of what we're in the business of doing.
Margie, you come at this from at least a couple of perspectives, having seen things through a media lens, through a creative agency lens. What do clients actually want at the moment? What are they finding hard?
I think there's a couple of things. It is about what does their brand stand for and how does that then go through their entire business, not just start and stop in the marketing team, and then through to their suppliers and their partners, and how does it look all the way through? And then what does data play in that role, and what part does it inform versus affect and impact out the other way?
Adam, if you were a marketer, what would you be thinking about? What would be sort of occupying your time?
Yeah, if I was a marketer, I'd be thinking about how to ensure everybody was on the same page as the terms of what it is. Everyone had a kind of a very, very clear North Star as to what was driving all of their decisions. And again, it just coming back to that human-centered design thing, if you ask somebody in that world, what's your North Star? They'll say, our North Star is to try to understand what makes it easier for the consumer. Whereas the North Star, from my understanding, should really always be about what's going to build the brand and build value into that brand. And then rolling that out across all, you know, whatever, however else you need to roll that through.
The agency that I'm, you know, a simple-minded trade press journalist who can generally hold one thought about an agency and what they stand for in the head. So it might be, you know, Zenith, the ROI agency, or, you know, I know Wavemaker are arguing, you know, we're the people who understand the marketing funnel. The one thing that Thinkabell stands for, what is it?
Scientific inquiry meets creativity.
Which we like to call measured magic.
Yes.
We rehearse that answer. But measured magic, you know, like everybody wants to find new opportunities and how to deliver on those and create a bit of creativity that's a bit magical. But, you know, it has to be accountable, it has to be measured, it has to be considered. And so that's what we kind of try to reconcile that trade-off.
Now, I guess about 4 months out from the M6, the Marketing Science Conference, which you curate and we put on. What can people look forward to for M6 this year?
It's looking very, very is exciting in terms of, can I say who's speaking or
you,
not?
You can, it depends what you've said to them, really. So you can say as much as you have confirmed, I suppose.
We've got Mr. Mark Ritson is going to be screaming obscenities from the stage and hopefully some wisdom as well. And we've also got...
That's a little Mumbrella Cast exclusive.
We've also got the producer of Australia's most successful reality TV show presenting. And the reason why he's presenting is there is still no better behaviour change vehicle in Australia than reality TV. And so I won't say where they're from or what the show is, but it's super, you know, it's the thing.
And
so
I know, and I'm excited.
Yeah, and I'm absolutely... this person's very... interesting, smart person, and so it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say. And then there's a raft of other good speakers as well.
Fabulous. Now, we are very nearly out of time. Perhaps both of you, tell me one thing you've learned at Mumbrella 360 this week.
I've learned to pay more attention to getting the technology organised before you present. Sorry, because I haven't had a time to actually hear as much content as I'd like.
Margie, what have you learned?
I sat in the Ubiquity misattribution and it was absolutely fascinating. It was just in terms of the scientific side of it and then also the gut side of it. And I think they even, you know, called out the polarizing part of that and how you have to sometimes go with your instincts. And then there's data to back it up.
And look, a massively complex topic. But what I thought was fascinating was just how busy that room was as well. Yeah. There's a lot of people who want to talk about attribution modelling.
Absolutely.
Oh, and just one of the other things, of the 180 segments, only three segments that you're at Mumbrella 360 have the word brand in the title. Just back to that whole point about getting brand back on the map.
And is that too many or too few?
Well, I don't know. It depends on what you're into.
Adam and Margie, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
God bless.
Welcome to the Wheel of Truth, our final session for Mumbrella 360. And this will also make up this week's Mumbrella cast as well. So hello, listeners. So about 9 months ago, I was sitting at the end of the day in the B.B. King Blues Club in New York for a session at Advertising Week conference, which was organized, that session was organized by DigiDay, and they had this brilliant idea for a session called Wheel of Truth, which was a lot of fun. And they came out carrying glasses of champagne, and I thought, I'm going to steal that format. So here we are. Now, I will introduce you to our panelists very shortly, but firstly, let me explain how the Wheel of Truth works. So over on the other side of the stage from me, you will notice the debonair Richard Reed, who will help sprinkle us some television glamour upon this session. Richard will be spinning the wheel and helping moderate questions from the room if there's time as well. Now, you will see that our wheel, which I sort of visualised would be a little bit bigger.
Got to give it a spin?
Yeah, yeah. Give it a demonstration
and when I
spin,
Richard. And when I spin it, I'm going to go, Wheel of Truth.
And okay, you will see that it will end on a number. The wheel contains 14 numbers, and each number corresponds to a tough question that we're going to be challenging our panel to tell you the truth about. So let me introduce our truth tellers. First, starting at the other end for me here, waving the flag for the media makers, we have Kim Portrait. She is... Kim is the first boss of TV industry body Think TV, which comes after a career in marketing with big brands like Unilever, Pepsi Cola, Optus, AMP, and Tourism Australia. Please welcome Kim. Next along is Kieran Moore, who is CEO of WPP's Public Relations and Public Affairs Operation in Australia, including Ogilvy, Haworth, and Pulse. She is, without question, Australia's most respected public relations executive. Please welcome Kieran. Next, we have Brent Smart, who moved client-side just over a year ago as CMO of insurance giant IAG. Prior to that, Brent had a massive agency career, including CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi in New York and managing director of one of the world's most creative agencies, Colenso BBDO in Auckland. Please welcome Brent. Well. And speaking of Colenso, Nick Garrett followed in Brent's footsteps at Colenso before taking the helm of Clemenger BBDO Melbourne 3 years ago. He took on the daunting task of modernising the structure of what was already recognised as one of the world's great agencies. Late last year, they added Clemenger Sydney to Nick's portfolio too, and he's currently on the shortlist for Mumbrella's Agency Leader of the Year. Please welcome Nick. And next to me comes James Greet, whose latest venture is strategy consultancy Clear Thinking. Not only does James have a distinguished career running some great media agencies, including OMD, Mindshare and Icon, but even better, he's currently not working for any of the big holding companies, so he'll be able to tell us where all of the bodies are buried. Please welcome James.
Yay!
And in the spirit of Wheel of Truth, I'm going to tell you what James just said to me as everyone was coming in and we were sitting on the stage looking at everyone. He said, "Is this what it feels like to be royal?" So let's get to it. Richard, would you please spin the wheel?
The Wheel of Truth. Number 13.
Here's a good one. I think we'll start. Actually, we'll start with Kim on this one. How much do you deserve to be paid?
Oh,
yeah, girl.
More.
Well, I think we could ask everybody in the room, and I think that we'd all know the answer, which is obviously more. Look, I'm pretty pragmatic. I think I'm deserve to be paid what someone's prepared to pay for me, essentially. I know that sounds sounds silly, but it's a hard question. It's a really hard question. A lot of our time spent on incentivizing and KPIing a lot of our teams to make sure that they've got some skin in the game. But what I find is that most people who are really in the industry and in for a long time and who really love it are kind of in there for all the other reasons that are not necessarily financial. You know, back to some of the points the guys made earlier about, you know, being part of a creative or dynamic team and making a contribution. But, you know, after two more glasses of champagne, you can ask me that question and I could probably answer honestly.
I'll get you to build on it a bit more as well.
Me? Jesus.
Lots more.
You know, it's a tough question because as people, I typically undervalue because you're never really good at selling yourself. You can sort of do that for lots of – like I could tell you what all these guys should get paid, but I'm not particularly good at telling you what I should. So – and rather than sounding less wanky and abstract, maybe the best way to figure that out is not market rate or maybe it's a percentage of the contribution you make. Like that would work really well for me because I'm in television. That'd be great. It might not work so well for everybody else, but yeah, look, you know, it's the last question I ask when I'm looking at a new opportunity. It's literally the last. It can be a showstopper, certainly, but you don't kind of walk in and go, well, I want another $50 or I'm not coming to talk to you. You go, what's the opportunity? What's the challenge? So it's more about kind of the excitement of what you're doing. And yes, I need to, you know, buy beans and pineapples and all the rest of it for the family, but it's not really the motivator.
So Brent, at what stage in the conversation about your current role did you talk about remuneration?
A bit like him, like quite late. I mean, for me, the whole reason I went client side was I got sick of running agencies and asking clients to do things that they should have been doing and they kept saying no. So I'm like, well, what if I could be the guy that says yes? So the motivation for me was all about making great work happen. Honestly, that is why I did it. And it's kind of interesting for me. I find myself, I'm off topic, but I'll come back. But I find myself in an insurance company. I was really worried it would be the most restrictive, constrained environment for a guy. I mean, look at me. But it's so liberating for me to be a CMO and to be able to actually make stuff happen. I've never been more excited. So, and again, I'm like Kim, the money for me has never been what's driven me, in this business. It's always been about the work.
Nick, would you do it for half the salary for the love of it?
Potentially. I'm 20 years in. I've never asked for a pay rise in my whole career. And I feel very lucky every day I wake up when I've got something I'm excited about and I'm looking forward to. Mm. I have my mantra, which I learned from a mutual friend of ours, Nick Worthington. If you don't have three things you're excited about right in front of you, then get out of your job. Mm. I think if you have them, and he's the greatest, you know, creative person I've worked with. I think you'd say the same.
Same, yeah.
I think that should be true for everyone. In terms of salaries and life and inflation and complexity, when I'm looking at a staff list now of over 400 people and I'm wondering how do I put them at finite resources against the people that I think I absolutely have to back, I back curiosity, passion, and willing over experience, because I think if someone's willing to put their head through a wall for you, they may not be that experienced, they may make a few mistakes, but you can trust them with everything. You just got to look after them on that journey. And I think there are a lot of people in every part of our world that want to be paid well but don't want accountability. If you are prepared to make tough calls, and it's heartbreaking sometimes, but you take it on the chin and you do it yourself, I think that's the thing. Don't ask someone to do something you wouldn't do yourself. And you look around, they're the people that you got to look after because they're the ones that define your culture and are worth the weight in gold.
Now, James, you've also worked as a headhunter as well. Are people actually good at asking what they're worth?
By and large, no. Certainly the ones that you think are best equipped to realise the role at hand, both technically and culturally, will focus on that conversation at the end. But by and large as well, most people are really uncomfortable talking about money as well. But I think, you know, we've all made kind of mistakes in our career. The only time I ever made a mistake in terms of where I chose to go was when I chose that role based upon the money that was being offered, which or the potential remuneration.
Which job was that?
I was my first job in advertising, actually, 30 years ago. I'm lying.
It wasn't your short stint at Icon.
No, not at all. It was to go and do a role where it was clearly danger money.
Yeah.
And I very soon quickly found out why. But what's also really interesting, I think, is someone touched upon it here earlier, as the client agency relationship seeks to move towards more value-based modelling as opposed to fees based upon head hours and percentages and so forth, because they're probably not as transparent as clients want them to be. I think it will be interesting to see how that trickles down to how the individuals working on that business are then paid and whether their contribution to, I guess, the agency's contribution on that that value-based project will follow suit as well. I mean, at Clean Thinking, the way we structured the fee-based model, and we're not selling Clean Thinking, it was just we gave a lot of thought about this, as you imagine, the first thing is, if a client asks us to do something, we say, so what is the purpose of this financially? Because if there's value in doing it, it's going to have an impact on the P&L somewhere. Either you're going to save money by doing it this way, or you're going to make more money. And we want our contribution to be recognised by an element of that.
Well, we might come back to that point more widely a little bit later, depending on the questions. Just before I ask Richard to spin the wheel, Kim, you wanted to come back in.
I had a question for James in his previous life as a headhunter. Are blokes better at asking for money than girls? Oh, is that wrong? Can I not ask that?
No, it's just the question of the room.
What? Maybe we should have... Is anybody interested in finding that out? All the girls, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or is that just a lie?
Why do you obviously kind of think that might be the case? Is that? Is that based upon the fact that you're very good at asking for...
No. It's because it's a conversation... Well, it's a conversation that I hear when professional women get together. And the conversation goes something, and I'm way off topic now. Sorry, Tim, you can shut me down. There is a view amongst some professional women that blokes are better at asking for cash and better at stepping into roles that they're potentially not as qualified for, whereas women will, and this again is the theory.
It's been proven. There's research that proves this.
So she says.
Well, there is.
Yeah. So I'm just curious.
Right. I think it's a fabulous question.
I'll get you to answer it fairly quickly, James. So
yeah.
So very
quickly. Yes, they probably are, because I think they're a lot more considered in their approach to big conversations and big subjects like that.
Ouch.
Than guys.
They think about it more.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think guys tend to be a lot more kind of emotional in stuff. They tend to be more ego-driven, whereas in my experience, females tend to be a lot more considered and less ego-focused.
Interesting. Thank you.
Mm. Richard, back to you.
Wheel of Truth.
Question number four. Does the media and marketing industry have a Me Too issue to deal with, and what needs to be done? Who wants to go at that one first?
I will. As one of the women on the panel, I think that the marketing and media industry has a massive diversity and inclusion issue. Whether that breaks down into the subset of, you know, Me Too and, you know, gender disparity and gender and sexual harassment, I've never seen personally. And I work for a very big organisation in this market. And I've also worked in, you know, abroad and in the UK and in Europe, and I didn't see, but what I've seen consistently over the 30 years is that diversity and inclusion is a bigger challenge. And I think if we were serious about addressing, you know, the gender disparity and inequality, whether it relates to pay or promotion or whatever it might be, by looking at it holistically around diversity and inclusion, I think we'd all be in much, much better shape. We've got a lot of white people on this stage, for example. So I think we could be a little bit better at hiring people that don't look like us.
James, you were trying to come in.
Look, I suppose my first observation when I saw the question is, and I know why it's there, but why is it even a question? It's a fact, I think, is what I'd say. I think the issue is, so what is the world going to do about it? I know the world probably wants to do a lot of stuff about it, but there are certain restrictions here in Australia that stop people speaking out, and fear is one of it. I think our industry has arguably always been full of bullies. It's been dominated by bullying. You know, this is a very extreme sort of example of that. But I think what will happen is the usual white middle-aged suspects that have run power bases over the last sort of 15, 20 years, those power bases have been eroded. And that removes, therefore, the fear of being shut out of an industry because you've spoken up about something. So it might take longer here. I hope it doesn't. But change will undoubtedly come.
Nick, I think I saw you nodding at that.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything James said. It's not a question. It's a fact. It's there. It's real. I'm 43 years old. I moved back to Australia in 99. And what I saw in 99 is very different to what I see in 2018. I think I speak for a lot of people of my generation, and the people that are running agencies, the people that are running clients, the people running organizations, there's a whole generation that's gone and left the industry. And I'm hoping that a lot younger, fresher, broader, more diverse thinkers have started to take over and aren't going to stand for that shit. It's disgusting, and it does need to be stand out. I think there's a danger of looking backwards and trying to correct some wrongs 10, 15 years ago. And there's some people that will get caught in the crosshairs. But there are people in our industry, like every one of them, that have behaved appallingly, and it's not good enough. I think we should be having a far bigger and more heated discussion of what we're all going to do collectively moving forward, because it can't, it cannot. I think it has decreased, and it needs to just be stamped out.
Kim, I'm going to come to you and then to Brian.
I agree with James, sadly. I suppose for me, the focus on that question is, what can I do? So I like the idea that the industry gets involved and wants to change things. But in the end, every day, I'm the person responsible for my own behaviour. So how can I create a safe environment? You know, I mentor people. I say to people, if you are uncomfortable or fearful, come to me. You know, there's always a way to get a message to somebody that needs a message given to them. So part of that is, I don't think you have to be a white 50-year-old man running an agency to be accountable and responsible. I think it's just as likely that you can be a 22-year-old brand manager. If you see bad behaviour, find someone safe in your organisation and speak to them. And look, you know, Mumbrella have done great work in making sure that some of this stuff surfaces. If there's no one in your business that you can trust, go and talk to somebody in the press. You know, like there's ways that if every single one of us in this room over the course of the next year just made a commitment that when you see that behaviour, you will stop it, you will offer support to the person that's suffering it, and you will take positive action to make sure that that doesn't happen to that person again. You know, it's a multiplier effect. We'll get there much faster if we just accept our own obligations.
Mm. Brent?
Yeah, I kind of agree with some of what Nick was saying about there's a danger that it can be quite backward-looking, and there's no doubt we have to right the wrongs and fix it.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in the positive future conversation about how do we fix the pay gap? How do we fix representation in senior management? It's really interesting now that I don't work in the marketing, in the media industry, the advertising industry. I work in an insurance company. You know, you'd think an insurance company would be the most 50-year-old white guy company you could be in. We, in my division, Customer Labs, we fixed the pay gap last year. And it's very doable. You just have to want to do it. So we said we've got X amount of budget that we've got for pay rises and incentives. Let's make sure we fix the pay gap first, and then we'll worry about, you know, how we fix high performers and whatever else. Let's just fix the pay gap. We wanted to do it. We did it. You can do it. You just have to want to do it.
Yeah.
Look, we could spend the whole afternoon talking about this because it's a really big topic, but yeah. There are a lot of other big topics as well. Richard, back to you.
We're going to get some truth. 14. Full so true, right? What I did right there.
Perfect. It's very well planned. Is the communications industry a force for good or bad?
I'll take it. Yeah. Good communications, force for good. Bad communications, fucking pollution, is my view of the world. And there's too much bad communication.
Yep. I think I can put some heat on that. This is an amazing country, and I don't know how many are Aussies here or now lovers of Australia have come from other countries. We seriously fucking underperform creatively, and we're doing our best work on small clients or small projects, and it is not good enough. Brent's words are absolutely right about pollution. You look at our work, it's short-term, it's unimaginative, it's not disruptive, it's not standing out, and it's not doing enough societally, and it should have a greater impact commercially. And if you're really, really interesting, you will have a commercial impact. And, you know, I think the world's going through a crisis of confidence. It's not just Australia, but Australia needs to do more brilliant work. We're a reasonably small country with a small workforce, with more barriers to get to great work. We've got people like this man who buy creativity on the marketing side, and I'm sure there's brilliant clients here, and I've got some I know in the audience who buy great work. But, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if there was like 20 things in the industry next year we're all sort of giddy with excitement because they were so good. And there aren't right now.
I kind of think it's like, it's exactly as Brent said, you know, it's like a baseball bat, isn't it? You can do good things with a baseball bat. You can do really unfortunate things with a baseball bat. I think what's holding us back in just being good all the time, though, isn't a skill shortage as such. You know, we were born a creative pioneering environment. You go back 40, 60,000 years and no one's still figured out how we created a boomerang. Right? In our latter years, we sort of innovated through necessity more than anything else. You know, you look at the businesses that we created here, you know, Qantas, a little airline out sort of the back of far northern Queensland, look at its growth and its kind of fame globally, et cetera, and then all this innovation in terms of technical innovation, Google Maps, Cochlear, and so on and so forth. But then somewhere we got really lazy, okay? And it was just good enough. And I think the last 10 years have probably been, not just in the creative sort of industry, but industry at large, somewhere we've just got really, really lazy because the sun's shining, we're digging heaps of money out the ground, and we don't have to worry about the future. But that's when we're at our best, when our backs are up against the wall and we're about to slide off the economic growth scale.
Brent, I will come back to you, but I'm going to come to Kim and Kieran first.
And that's where we'll lean into it, and the communications industry has to put itself at the front of that.
So I'm a crap judge of good and bad. I'll put that out there straight away. I don't think I can really tell the difference. Typically stuff I really like, everyone else hates. And the stuff that I really hate, everybody else likes. So I'm pretty crap judge at that. But I think there's a better question. So good or bad is kind of like a report card, right? Like, are we doing well or not doing well? And I actually don't think that that's the right measure for us. I think, you know, accountants don't sit around waxing lyrically about whether they're a force for good or a force for bad. I think we've got our head up our asses, and that what we should be thinking about is, are we what we've got on the tin? So my good's your bad, your bad's my good. At the end of the day, who cares? As long as it's not really terrible, like bad things, but if it's just sort of general, like maybe that's the wrong question. And, you know, I don't think anybody is sitting around worrying about whether we're good or bad. I think they're worrying about whether we work.
Okay, Kieran, then Brent, and we'll go to the wheel again.
I think you should, because you were hot on that topic.
No, I just find it really surprising, especially from you. You won 52 Lions at Cannes last year. Australia was third in the world at Cannes. I don't know if it's an Australian problem. I worked in America for 8 years. Jesus. The amount of shit that comes out of that country. I mean, you know, I don't know if it's an Australian thing. I actually think at our best, Australia is we can take on the world, and we can have these incredibly like Graham and like the Lamb work, and there's some work out of Australia that's just so.
But we can do
great
more
and amazing.
It.
Yeah, but I think pound for pound, we do really. And New Zealand, where I worked for 5 years, does even better than us. For, you know, if you want to talk about New Zealand's love per capita, they win that all the time. but I don't know. I don't know if it's an Australian thing. I actually think we're pretty good. And again, you've come off the best can we've ever had. I don't know why we sort of think Australia's not creative enough. I don't know.
Kieran, I want to know what you think.
I think we do some great work, and I think we do some appalling work. And I think a lot of it's got to do with the caliber of the people that are paying our bills. Mm. So it's fantastic, you know, to have an ex-agency, leading agency person in as CMO. That doesn't happen very often. Mm. So, you know, in the spirit of, you know, keeping the work going and all of those sorts of things, you know, we do compromise. And that's why I think, and we don't want to compromise, but we just have to compromise. Either we're lacked by the imagination of our clients or the budget. I don't think it's necessarily to do with the quality of the people that are coming up with the ideas. I think what is really powerful when we do get it right is when we do work around purpose, or when we're tapping into something that people are really unhappy about, whether it's, you know, how badly asylum seekers or refugees are being treated, or how, whatever it might be. That's when you see the real power of how we can change the needle and things, whether there's purpose behind it and there's a real social cause behind it. That's when I think we really shine. But it's, you know, it's shit in and shit out. You get a shit brief and you've got a client that doesn't want to make any, you know, bold decisions, then, you know, you can challenge, but you can also be paralyzed.
But you're talking about whether creativity is good or bad, not whether communications, because I don't think anyone's going to go, yep, creativity is bad. But that's not the question.
No, I think it's got to move you, and it can move you without being insanely creative. It can be strategic. It can tap into you emotionally. Yeah, okay.
Nick has been trying to get in, so I'm going to come to that.
I just want to close, because I think we've merged two questions. Mm. First one is the communications industry, a force for good or bad. It has to be good, right? None of you are here to do bad. We're not here to do bad. So can we just, like, is it for good or bad?
Good.
Good. Good. Right? Done. Have we offered an opportunity to be more creative and do more interesting things for our punters? Yeah, we do. So let's give it a nudge.
Okay, well, let's keep moving. I think we've probably spent a fortune renting these throwable microphones, and we haven't used them at all for the whole conference. So I think this is time to discover Richard's throwing skills.
Has anyone
skills.
Got a question? Who wants to ask a question? It's coming your way, fast. The first I'm just going to throw it this way, and whoever catches it.
I see a hand over this way, Richard.
Oh, that, I'm supposed to throw. I'm going to do an underhand. Here you go.
Oh, pretty good.
And if you could please tell us who you are and where you're from, please.
Hello, I'm Kim. I'm from Orchard. And my question is there an age limit or expiry date in creative industry?
I hope not.
You look at the old people. You look at the old people. One of us.
I only had that way to go.
Yeah, we're on the 50-plus side of the panel, putting
not.
It out there.
Well, I am. I think the testimony to no, big no.
Yeah.
No.
There's a limit. I think commitment, passion, and hard work.
Let me just challenge you on that, then. Why aren't there many people over the age of 50 in agencies, then?
Oh, because it's exhausting.
Yeah, because you get tired.
If you can last at 50, it's a miracle. But if you look at, look at other creative industries, and look at, you know, the creativity that's coming from, like, Paul Smith in his 70s, that's coming from, you know, some film, like, you know, Ridley Scott in his 70s, and, you know, creativity doesn't stop. And I think if you look beyond our industry, people do some of their best work. I mean, Bourdain was 44 before he was discovered as a writer. I mean, what a tragic loss he is. I mean, I just think there is no age limit on creativity. I think there is a real, it's hard to keep going in advertising agencies. I think it's really hard, and I wouldn't want to be doing it.
I agree. I think you're more likely to get tired than you are to get old.
I think there's a bit of a statute of limitations on the amount of stuff you have to deal with, that probably as you get a bit older, you think, you know, probably other things I could be doing. I'm with everyone else on the panel.
I think there's a distinct difference between is there an age limit on people in agencies versus their capability to contribute to solving clients' business issues and whichever way creativity needs to be deployed. I think I think people of a certain age and beyond are increasingly going to find the energy taken to run and keep an old school agency model going is just too hard. Okay.
That was such a. I'm sorry to cut you short slightly. That was such a good question from the floor. I think we'll invite another.
Another
one.
Here we go. Ready? It's side. Nice and soft, so don't worry. Ah.
My question relates to the capability you think that agencies have to actually deliver commercial results for clients. And, you know, we know there's a lot of capability from a creative perspective, but does that always translate commercially? And do you think there's inherent capability there?
Let's go to a marketer, first of all, for that one.
Oh, I think for me, there's two capabilities that agencies have that are incredibly lacking in corporates and incredibly lacking in the big consultancies. And I'm going to say creativity, ideas, proper ideas. Ideas that you can say in a tweet, not in 100 slides of PowerPoint. Ideas that move people. Ideas that that you know everyone gets excited about inside a company. They're such rare things. They're fragile things. They're really hard to find. Agencies still know how to do it, and it's an incredible, incredible skill that every marketer should be prepared to pay a lot of money for, because you're not going to get it. In my experience, you're not going to get it anywhere else. You're certainly not going to get it inside your organization. The second thing, which I think is massively underrated in agencies, is the ability to simplify. And I grew up in advertising when we used to have to do lots of posters and you just have to say things in 30 seconds. And the founder of Colenso, Roger McDonnell, who's one of my heroes, I'll never forget, we were pitching the Bank of New Zealand and the pitch briefing took them 3 hours to take us through about 200 slides of PowerPoint. And Roger has got this great husky Kiwi accent. He says, "Now let me get this straight. You want me to say in 30 seconds what just took you 3 hours to tell me?" Which is, but I think that skill of being able to distill the very complicated, and especially in an industry like mine, like in insurance or in banking or in telcos, just to distill it down to the essence of what's really going to matter to a human being, to find those beautiful universal insights, like you're not you and you're hungry, or like it's such a beautiful skill that I've never seen anywhere else. Be developed like it is in agencies. And I just hope it's still being developed in agencies like it was when I grew up in agencies, because I'm thankful every day that I grew up in agencies and I learned those skills. It makes me such a better marketer. And I wouldn't have learned it if I grew up client side. I wouldn't have learned it if I grew up at a consultancy. And I just think agencies don't stop and realize the beautiful skills they have inside, you know.
That was a great question and a great answer. And I think we'll move on to the next topic so that we cover some ground. If Richard, if you would like to.
Oh, Wheel of Truth.
Question number two. When should an agency lie to a client?
Nick should take that one. All the time.
Look, I don't think you should ever lie. You shouldn't lie to anyone. It's not a good thing. And, you know, if you're. There was a two words that we used at Colenso, which I've taken with me. It's about love and trust. If you trust someone, you create love. And if you love them, you will trust them. And in a relationship, this is creative partner to agency lead, to planner to everyone. It's a cultural thing and it's a cultural client. So you're going to go through horrifically hard times. A client has to respect the fact that you might not have the answer or you might not have the solution at the time they want it. If they love and trust you, they'll accept, buy me time to do something. Has anybody in this room not given half a truth or bent around something to get to a better outcome? Yeah, I have. I've shown confidence in moments of extreme pressure and adversity.
So it's okay to bullshit a client, not lie to a client.
I'd say it's okay to be confident when you're not and showing that you are going to get to a solution. But to lie is just not cool. It's not cool. You're never going to get to a great place. And if you're finding yourself that you have to lie to someone, you're already fucked and the relationship's destroyed. And I think if you look at your personal life, you'd probably say the same is true, I hope.
So I think the other thing about, I agree with everyone, you never lie ever. One, because you always get caught. Mm. So that's the first thing. So you get caught sooner or later. But I think the other thing is it's easy for senior people with lots of experience to say that. But certainly for me, telling everybody in this room, you've got to work in a company where it's okay to make mistakes and to come clean and put your hand up and say when you've made a mistake. When I first started at Ogilvy PR a few years ago, There wasn't a culture of always telling the truth, and people were hiding and they weren't always doing the right thing. And sure enough, what was a tiny little white lie turned into this monumental, you know, greatest, you know, catastrophe. So having an agency or a team environment where you're allowed to, you know, and we created a thing called My Biggest Fuck Up. And the deal was that you had to stand up and talk about when you made a mistake. Namely, it was when you hadn't been quite truthful, and then talk about what you learnt from that experience and then share it. So there was a vulnerability with that. And I think that certainly in the 30 or so years I've been in agencies, there's a lot more vulnerability and humility now in terms of the people, the way they act. And that's a good thing.
I want to say one thing. Most powerful words in the world is, I don't know. And an agency's job is not to know everything and have every answer every time. And when you're presenting the most audacious work or the most audacious thinking in the world, client says, how do you know it's going to work? You don't. Now, we can go through research, we can go through a process, or how do you know the treehouse or Graham is going to work, or how are you going to make it? You don't. You go, but give me a week, give me a month, give me a day, give me 6 weeks. Let's work this out together. And that shared responsibility and accountability, if you're in an environment like that, you're never going to lie. You shouldn't have to lie, but it goes both ways.
Now, let me just get some feedback from the room. The clock is telling me we're nearly out of time. Hands up if you'd like to go another 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Thank you. Mm. And if you do have to be somewhere, we won't judge you if you do have to slip away. Let's go for the wheel.
There we go. Ooh. Well, there we go. Have we done six?
We've done six.
Did we do seven?
We didn't do seven.
Seven!
Where do you draw the line? James, I don't think I came to you on the last question.
Where do I draw the line? So in the spirit of not lying and telling the truth, I think assuming you are an honest person full of integrity, you draw the line that anything you wouldn't be prepared to do yourself, have someone do for you. And ultimately, that I think that really depends, does it not, on your own makeup and your own sense of sort of like values and what you consider a priority. And I think it's interesting that question earlier about should you ever lie? Because I think that word has probably begun to mean different things over the last 30 years. I'd say that, yes, fine, truth well told and all that stuff and all the mantras in advertising. I think you go back 30, 40 years, the industry was brilliant at lying about stuff because it was brilliant at making people want stuff and believe it gave them special virtues and powers. Whereas now, in a post-truth age, the focus on the truth is greater than it's ever been before. And I guess it's how agencies deal with the future while still somehow retaining the essence of what made them great over the last 30 years and keep going, even though I think that word, a lie, and therefore, where do you draw the line, has probably changed and is consistently changing.
Last one's to come in on that one.
Personal contracts for me. So it's not like a... Like, nobody likes lies and nobody likes lazy people and all that kind of stuff. But for me, if we've got a deal where we've committed, I'm going to do this and you're going to do that, whether you're agency or whether you're part of my team or whether you're a client, doesn't really matter. If we have a deal that we're going to do one and one and you don't deliver, then the behavior has to change. So it's all about output focus for me.
I've got Nick. Two, I will not let my staff get shouted at and treated badly by clients, and I will happily go to a CEO or a CMO to request that person's removed or we won't work with them again. And I've done that more often than I want to, and I've walked away from a client once for it. And I think my personal one is I will never sell work I don't believe in, and I'd rather be humiliated because of time or anything else. And I've been in meetings where I'm going, I have to say, I don't think we've done enough or we haven't gone hard enough. I'm scared sometimes when the client thinks it's good and we don't, or someone on my own team thinks it's good and it's not, but I'm never going to sell work I don't believe in. I can't do it. I can't fake it. And it's just a waste of time.
Where do you draw the line?
I think it's probably the same thing I tell my 11-year-old daughter. It's that any time that you feel like you're being compromised or you're feeling uncomfortable, you don't go near it. So it's got a lot to do with your personal values. And if you think that you're compromising those, then there's a 99 to 100% chance that you are compromising them. Similarly, I've resigned clients. because they haven't been aligned with our values. And, you know, and that's disappointing, but it's also fantastic to stand up for something. And if you can't stand up for your teams and your own personal integrity, then, you know, what do you got left, really?
Brent?
I've got a really simple line. It's being a good dad. And that's the one line I'll never cross, whether it's a work trip and I'll miss something that's important to them, or whether it's I'm feeling the job's taking me away from being a good dad. And also it's like I want to make work that they don't think's lame. So that's it for me. That's the line I will never cross.
Okay. Next spin, please, Richard.
Wheel of Truth.
Oh, five.
Five. What was the worst day of your professional career?
I'll go. I was April the 8th, 2015. It was my birthday and I was in Mexico. I was CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi New York at the time. That was the toughest job I've ever had. Saatchi & Saatchi was a great agency to run in 1983, not such a great agency to run in 2015, pitching against Droger 5 and Wieden Kennedy, and it was pretty hard. And I had to do a lot of hard stuff. Nick used the word heartbreaking before. I had to do a lot of heartbreaking stuff. And I fired a guy, one of those digital guys who's lovely but does nothing. Anyway, an all-staff email went out from someone called Vox Saatchi to all staff at Saatchi New York saying what a horrible leader I am, how Saatchi's a sinking ship, it's all my fault, how I need to be fired immediately. All sorts of stuff, super defaming. And then that gets leaked to Agency Spy, which is worse than Campaign Brief. And I got, it's like character assassination like never seen. And I was on holiday in Mexico and the global CEO calls me because he's seen it. So that was the worst day of my career. Yeah.
I'm not going to say, we were in a difficult situation with a very, very, very big client, and it doesn't matter who it is and what category it was, but we both shared it, Brent. And we thought we're hand in hand with a client, and after the last meeting, before we were going to present to the CEO 3 or 4 days later, the senior client, who was new to an organization, and 6 months prior, we got a 9 out of 10 and got the best score for agency and client relationship anywhere in the world out of like 150 clients, agency client scores. He said, oh, this is really interesting, but I'm not going to stand next to you when you present it to my C-suite because I just wanted to hedge my bets, and I've asked 2 other agencies to turn up 1 hour and 2 hours after you. And that was really difficult to take. So that afternoon, we resigned the account, and I had to let 20 people go that day. And I was at the pub with them all, and that was horrific. I hope I never, ever, ever have to do that again. There's things we do differently. I'm not blaming the client. That's not what this is about. You have to take accountability and shared responsibility. I've never had someone do that. I don't think it's the organization. I think it's a person. But it was an untenable situation we just didn't want to be part of. But that cost 20 people their job, but had to do it.
James. And
this is why people don't stay in advertising to old ages. Days like that.
I think this conversation that goes along as the potential becoming quite Monty Python-esque, doesn't it, in terms of cardboard box on side of motorway. I'm just deciding which way I'm going to go, actually. I think sort of like personally, professionally, a young guy, 29, I'd given up a really good job in London. Probably the first ever person to resign in London in the mid-90s. I was at PhD at the time, a really interesting business that started going 3 years before. It's probably the only person in that decade to resign to go and work in China. I remember looking on David Patterson's kind of face, China, like they have an agency. And I went there to be the media director of Saatchi & Saatchi in 94. And a couple of days later, or a couple of months later, I'm sitting in a hotel lobby in Hong Kong the weekend before I'm going into China. And we had basically one client. It was 95% of our billings at the time, P&G, soon to become massive. And the person who's hired me, the CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi, has sat me down, welcomed me to Hong Kong. He says, look, we're going to Guangzhou on a Monday. Let me just sort of update you on the situation. Yeah, brilliant. Okay, I'm ready. You know they put us on review. No, I didn't. How long ago did they
put us on review. Well, they put us on review about a year ago for 6 months. I went, what happened? We've survived again? It goes, we got 0 out of 5. And, 0 is not good and 5 is brilliant. Go, yeah. But there was nowhere else to give the business to because another agency is here. So they rolled it over again. It's like, okay, so we've got another six months starting now. No, that started 3.5 months ago. Right. Okay. So we've got 10 weeks left to save the business and my job and everything. Yeah. So what have you done since then? Hired you. And I remember at that time thinking, oh, what am I going to do? I mean, I haven't unpacked.
I just go. Good that you hadn't.
Maybe that's why they bought me a one-way ticket or whatever. But at the same time, I just thought, well, what the hell? I'm 29. No one else is going to be working in China in the mid-90s. What's the worst thing that can go wrong? I know they might blame me if that is the case, but if it does work, then brilliant. Anyway, like a few months later, we'd sort of like sorted it out and we're getting letters from the great CEOs or Saatchis in the early 90s. And it was all very good. And that sort of like that 3 years in China, probably, you know, I still bear the scars, but it was probably the most prominent sort of like period of my career.
Thank goodness for a happy ending towards the end of the session. Kim?
So I remember the date as well. It was November 14, 2001. I had just given birth 2 days after. And at the time, I was the head running planning for a creative agency in New York. And so I didn't know what I was doing with this new baby. I just was hoping I wouldn't kill it. You know, so a bit nervous. And 2 days after she was born, I get a call from my boss and I thought, oh, this is really sweet. You're amazing. So congratulating me on the birth and letting me know that they understood that I would be under pressure and that it would take more of my time to look after a baby. So the great news was they were providing me with some support, which was a replacement.
Oh, wow.
So they made me redundant 2 days after. And then it was even worse, actually, because I'd built the team and they said, look, your team's going to be really upset that, you know, we've made this decision. So would you come back as a consultant for a couple of weeks and sort of bed down the new head of planning?
Did you?
No, I told them to fuck off. That's a true story.
I'm done. And Kieran, finally.
I don't know. They're pretty tough to beat. I was working. I went to London when I was 26, a long time ago. Went over there for 6 months and stayed for 14 years. But what I didn't plan on doing when I got to London was, it being the middle of a time where you couldn't get any work at all. At least, let alone a 26-year-old, you know, Australian. So I ended up taking this job at an agency that I knew was dodgy. Not dodgy, but just not quite pucker. But I just knew that I had to pay the rent. So for all of those of you who've seen Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, yes. So, you know, the gangster scenes, that's where I worked, down at London Bridge, so just near Borough Market, in an old banana warehouse. Just gets better, doesn't it? And then I got to a couple of months and I realised that they didn't have the money to pay me. So not only had I joined a really dodgy firm, they obviously didn't have their books in order and it was getting to Christmas time. So it is sounding like a Monty Python living in a cardboard box. And I remember thinking, this is really quite dire. Anyway, and I remember being quite outraged and I demanded that they give me the 300 quid that was in the petty cash box, because I thought, what, I've got to do something where I was resourceful. And that's what I did. And I managed to, through a great Aussie mate of mine, get another interview probably about a month later. But I think I probably survived on 300 quid in London for 3 months.
Wow.
So that would be my, that was my woes me story, yeah. But I think yours wins.
James has one final point, which he's going to make in less than 15 seconds.
Yeah, what could have been the worst day of my career was in my first week in a new agency, striding purposefully into the bathroom, locking the door, sitting down, and then hearing a couple of people come in, female voices, and realising... Realising I was sitting in the ladies' toilet.
And on that bombshell... That is almost where we have to finish. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to thank our speakers. Firstly, I need one more thing from you. We need to take a vote on truth, most of the truth, none of the truth. So show of hands, have you heard all of the truth? I see a few hands. Thank you. Have you heard most of the truth? That's very generous. A lot of hands. Or have you heard none of the truth? I can see no hands at all. That's very, very kind. Now, for those listening to the Mumbrella Cast, thank you for listening and toodle pip. For now, though, please join me in thanking the fantastic Richard Reeve, along with Kim, Kieran, Brent, Nick and James.
Well done.